My name is Jed Stone. I represent the appellant, Leslie McPherson. What color is your bra?
Pant.
Does it match your panties?
Are you speaking to Judge Crozier? Judge
I'm repeating the words of Randall Copenharve, Ms. McPherson's supervisor at her workplace in the city of Waukegan, the defendant and the appellee in this case. I appreciate the court's humor, but for Ms. McPherson, this was not funny. Our daughters don't deserve to work in an environment like that. It is intolerable. It is intolerable both objectively and subjectively.
Apparently the city of Waukegan agrees with you, doesn't it?
Well,
this fellow was out the door as soon as they heard anything about it.
I wish that that were true. He was out the door the day that it became known that he had digitally raped Ms. McPherson. But when supervisors knew and heard that he had said to Ms. McPherson and others, what color is your bra? Does it match your panties? When supervisors heard that, they did nothing.
What evidence was put forward that Copenhagen's supervisors had knowledge of his dreadful comments before March of 2001?
Justice Rovner, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
There
are two supervisors who knew, a Ms. Nieves and a Ms. Wayland. Ms. Wayland even went so far as to tell Mr. Copenhagen, oh, Randy, just get back to work. Their knowledge by hearing the conduct is knowledge imputed to the city. And the conduct is not just trivial, it's offensive. It's offensive in the same way that saying to a black man, oh, why don't you sing for us, Tom? Or saying some anti-Semitic slur to a Jewish employee. It's equally offensive to say to a woman, what color is your bra? Does it match your panties? And worse than that, Your Honors, the conduct escalated. It escalated from what color is your bra? Does it match your panties? To it actually coming over and pulling the blouse or top of Ms. McPherson over to see what color her bra was.
And did the supervisors know about that?
I don't think they did.
Okay.
I don't think they did. And then Ms. McPherson was called into Copenhagen's office and was groped, and then several...
Yes, of course. That's separate from the question what the supervisors knew and what they should have done on the basis of what they knew.
What
should they have done, do you think?
I think they should have alerted the city. I think they should have reprimanded Copenhagen, and they should have created an environment where women didn't have to fear that their supervisor would
now
ask them this question.
That's too vague. Do you think their reprimanding Copenhagen would have prevented the acts that occurred subsequently?
I think it very well might have. I think that in our life's experiences, Judge, when the authorities from the top down, I think it was Michael Dukakis that said the fish rots from the head down, when the people at the very top say, you can't do it, Mr. Copenhagen, you can't be a supervisor in our building department and ask women what color is your bra, that Mr. Copenhagen would then have been on notice.
Here's the catch 22. She needs to say that the comments were so terrible that they constitute a constructive discharge. But if they are that terrible, doesn't that suggest that she was unreasonable not to complain about them? That's the problem.
I think that question, with respect, when answered in the rarefied atmosphere of this chamber, is a very different answer when answered in the reality of the workplace. This is a working mother, a wife.
How old is she?
Mid-30s.
How old is Copenhagen? Where's Copenhagen?
I'm guessing. He's a retired firefighter, so he's in his late 40s, early 50s. I don't know. That's a guess.
Just curious, oddly.
He had worked for over 30 years for Waukegan.
Right. He was a firefighter, then a lieutenant in the fire department.
Now, what's his business with the Victoria's Secret catalog?
Frankly, I think it's a red herring. I think it is of no moment that...
Is that improper? Should they have been disciplined for looking through a book of... a magazine, or whatever it is, a catalog of women's underwear?
You mean should women at the workplace be prohibited from having a catalog of clothing items, underwear, and sharing it with each other? I can't imagine why.
Well, but it feeds this atmosphere, right? I mean, what are people in the workplace doing poring over catalogs of underwear?
Or anything on the job. I mean,
well, not anything, underwear.
I can't explain that, Judge.
Well, it creates the wrong atmosphere, doesn't it? It invites this kind of stuff.
Oh, I don't believe that, and I don't believe you mean to suggest that...
Yes, I do mean to suggest that...
That Ms. McPherson
I'm
was...
I'm teasing you.
That Ms. McPherson was inviting these...
The fellow goes over, and he sees these women poring over a catalog about underwear, so he makes a comment about underwear.
Regretfully, I think you're blaming the victim, Judge.
Precisely.
I
victims who act stupidly cause trouble for themselves, don't they? I'm just asking, if what you want to do is purge the workplace of sexually suggestive activities, comments, and so on, why wouldn't it include discouraging people from passing around underwear catalogs?
It certainly might, and you know or don't know, I'll tell you that from my perspective, I wish there hadn't been a Victoria's Secrets catalog in this case.
I agree.
Because I think it does undermine the righteousness of my position. But the truth is that even with that catalog, a supervisor is out of line asking the women who work under his supervision, what color is your bra? Does it match your pants?
Actually, no, it's not. Look, let me ask you another question. I'm puzzled by a feature of your case. What is this business about seeking indemnity under state law with respect to Copenhagen? What's that about?
That's about Mr. Copenhagen on the job at the workplace.
Look, indemnity, the statute you quote is about indemnifying a person who is hit with a judgment, right? Well, there isn't any judgment. He's not a party.
Well, he is a party, Judge.
Well, he's not listed as a party. What did you list him as a party?
He was a party in the action in the district court, Judge.
And what happened?
He was dismissed.
No, what do you mean he's dismissed? Was there a judgment against him?
No, there was
not. Then how do you get indemnity if there's no judgment?
Because we...
You're not appealing his dismissal.
We're not, Judge.
How can you get indemnity for a non-existent judgment?
We believe that the city should be forced to...
What are you talking about? Look at the statute you quoted.
Judge, it's our position that the city of Waukegan...
Look, where is that statute? What does the statute say?
It's on page 2021 of our brief, Judge. Our position is that Mr. Copenhagen's conduct is within the scope of his employment, that the action...
Look, you cite a statute which is about indemnification for judgments, and there is no judgment, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Actually, I believe the city cited the statute. What we cited was the restatement second of agency, in which Illinois courts have often relied upon and recognizes that section 231 and comment A, that minor crimes committed in the prosecution of a business can reasonably be anticipated, and in section 245, that an unauthorized use of force can lead to a master's liability if the act was not unexpected in view of the duties of the servant.
Look, on page 16 of your... In the appendix, so this is page 16 of the appendix, the district court claims that you sought indemnity under the Illinois Tort Immunity Act. Is that correct? Or was that the basis on which you sought indemnity?
That is correct.
And that statute says a local public entity is empowered and directed to pay any tort judgment for which it or an employee, while acting within the scope of his employment, is liable. Well, there isn't any judgment.
Well, Judge, I think the district judge put the horse before the cart, or the cart before the horse. We are claiming that under Illinois state law, that the sexual misconduct of Mr. Cope, that because of the sexual conduct of Mr. Copenharb, the city is liable under a theory of vicarious liability. The district judge cited the Illinois Tort Immunity Act as an act which protected the city. It was not our position that the Illinois Tort Immunity Act should be...
So he misrepresented your count five, is that what you're saying?
I think our count five is accurately represented on page 21 of our brief. The district court rejected, I'm quoting Ms. McPherson's claim, and found that the Illinois Tort Immunity Act protected the city.
Now, why do you... You don't, however, develop... I mean, the general rule is that employers are not liable under respondeat superior for intentional torts of their employees, but in certain circumstances they can be if the employee is acting in furtherance. But you don't develop any of this.
Judge, our position developed in the facts below are that Randall Copenharb
is... What is the standard that you believe governs employers' liability for intentional torts or crimes by employees?
If Mr. Copenharb was acting within the scope of his employment, the city of Waukegan should be liable for the damages...
No, but now you're saying that the employer is liable for any criminal activity by its employee, which is obviously wrong.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the city knew that...
What is the standard?
The standard is a standard of vicarious liability.
What is the content of the standard?
Where the city knew or should have known that
their... That's different. That's saying the city was negligent.
Where the city knew or should have...
No, that's saying it's negligent. Respondeat superior is strict liability. We understand your argument that the city was negligent. That's your basic claim. You want somehow to attach liability to the city automatically on the basis of what Copenharb did, not on the basis of what the city did.
Randall Copenharb was an employee of the city.
But an employer is not liable for every act that an employee commits on the premises.
I agree
if
with
Copenharb
that.
Had murdered one of his supervisees for purely personal reasons, that wouldn't impose liability on the city. So what's the difference?
Judge, I see that I'm out of time. I think the difference is that in a context of escalating sexual harassment, the city was on notice that...
That's separate. You don't need notice for respondeat superior. Don't you understand? That's a completely different approach.
I do understand, but you're asking...
You don't need notice. You need something else. What you need is that the employee is somehow acting in furtherance of his employer's business.
I believe that when Mr. Copenharb called Ms. McPherson into his office, that he was acting as a city employee on city time. And when he digitally raped Ms. McPherson, the city should be held responsible.
Do you have any cases where employers are held liable for rapes by their employees?
No.
they haven't looked into. You haven't actually researched this issue.
Oh, I think we have researched.
Well, you haven't looked for the rape cases, right?
I think
you haven't cited any. You haven't found any, maybe. They have no precedent for your position.
I'm unaware of precedent for the position.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Stout.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Golub?
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor, I think it's important that we focus our attention on the actual facts of this case. As is pointed out at the start of the city's brief, the appellant's brief is more of an exercise in creative writing as opposed to the actual facts. And the facts, I believe, as the panel has recognized, demonstrate that prior to March 21st, what we are talking about here are a handful of comments, quite literally, over a period of 3 years, and one incident where Mr. Copenhagen pushed aside the tank top and asked again, "What color is your bra?" That is the sum total of everything that occurred prior to March 21st, 2001.
Let's go. Why can't the office manager's knowledge of his boorish behavior be imputed to Waukegan? In other words, shouldn't she have notified his supervisor of his behavior when she heard it? Behaving inappropriately.
In certain circumstances, I certainly agree that a supervisor's knowledge of boorish conduct could be imputed. However, what we're talking about here is that on one occasion, Michelle Wieland heard Mr. Copenhagen make this comment, to which she responded, knock it off and get back to work. So should she have then escalated it? No, we don't agree with that because we're talking about one comment. And in fact, Ms. McPherson herself never complained, not in that moment, not at any other time, and in fact never went to Michelle Wieland, who was, in addition to being a supervisor, one of Ms. McPherson's very close friends and neighbors for years. So is Ms. Wieland to be considered to assume that that was one comment was a hostile environment? The only other evidence is evidence from not Ms. McPherson, but a co-worker, Ms. Brewington, wherein she believes that Ms. Nieves, another supervisor, possibly overheard 2 to 3 comments over the course of 2 years. So, no, I don't agree that is sufficient knowledge of, one, a hostile environment, or, two, that knowledge without any complaint amounts to the standard to impute liability to the city.
Is there any evidence that Copenhagen harassed anybody else?
There is no such evidence. From the start of this case, Ms. McPherson has constantly alleged that there is some history, but the very first complaint of any misconduct against Mr. Copenhagen in his 25 years of employment with the city was the complaint that Ms. McPherson brought to her sister-in-law, the mayor's daughter, on March 26, 2001. As the panel is aware, on March 27, 2001, Mr. Copenhagen was removed permanently and forever from the workplace with no discussion. And, in fact, Ms. McPherson herself was gratuitously granted 30 days leave immediately within 1.5 hours of her telling the mayor's daughter-in-law that this had happened. She was given 30 days paid leave. That leave was not detracted in any way from any other leave to which she was entitled. After the expiration of that leave, she was sent a notice saying that she was still entitled to 22 additional days leave, which she had built up, paid leave. And at the end of that period in time, she was told that she would have to apply for a discretionary leave if she wanted to stay out.
Will the record tell us who brought the complaint to the state's attorney?
No, the record will not. Ms. McPherson, in her brief, cites some background and history of the case against Mr. Copenhagen. However, as I'm sure the court noted, there is absolutely no evidentiary support in the record or otherwise for those statements about Mr. Copenhagen's case. It certainly is established and indisputable that Mr. Copenhagen did plead guilty to a misdemeanor. However, Mr. Copenhagen, in fact, when he was confronted by the city on March 27th, maintains that the conduct was consensual, and it, certainly that's not an issue here, because for purposes of summary judgment, primarily, we wouldn't take issue with that.
Was Neves deposed?
Was Neves deposed? Yes, she was.
Pardon?
Yes, she was.
So what did she say in her deposition?
She denied any knowledge of any comments. She denied any understanding of anything prior to March 21st, and I think that's evident from the fact that her deposition was not used by Ms. McPherson in support of her case.
Really?
I'm sorry.
I'm trying to jog my memory. Who was it that walked in during this event?
On the first instance, March 21st, which took place behind closed doors, nobody walked in. And Ms. McPherson left the office, went back to her desk, finished out the day.
Someone walked in.
Right. On the second instance, the first was on Wednesday, the second was on the following Monday. Again, Ms. McPherson walked into the office, closed the door. While the incident occurred, Ms. Wieland walked into the office, and best we can understand is, if the office door opens, she walked in, apparently, and according to Ms. McPherson, Mr. Copenhagen shoved Ms. McPherson behind the door so that the door would close. Ms. Wieland walked in, put something on the desk, walked out, and shut the door again. At no time did Ms. McPherson cry out to Ms. Wieland, get her attention, or take the opportunity to leave the office. So Ms. Wieland walked in and walked out uneventfully, after which Ms. McPherson again returned to her desk to finish out the day and did not complain until the next day to her sister-in-law, Ms. Vanderventer, I believe, excuse me. I did want to address the issue of constructive discharge, particularly in light of the court's very recent decision in the Robinson case. We recognize that the decision is not so much of a departure from the court's prior precedent, but certainly a change and a new development in this area of the law. In Robinson, of course, as you know, the court determined that constructive discharge can, in fact, be a tangible employment action for purposes of the Farragher and Ellis analysis. We assert, as in prior cases, there really is no need to address the issue of whether constructive discharge amounts to a tangible employment action in this case, because the evidence falls painfully shy of establishing a constructive discharge. I won't address the handful of comments that happened before March 21st, but will address instead the events that transpired after March 27th, and in fact, the very things that Ms. McPherson, in her deposition and in her brief below, relied upon to establish.
Why would it be significant whether constructive discharge was an adverse employment action? The circumstances that led up to the constructive discharge would be the adverse action, the harassment, wouldn't it?
Well, actually, the constructive discharge claimed in this case are the events that happened after the harassment, the March 21st, or even if you were to consider the attacks themselves. As the court below commented, those events ended the minute Mr. Copenhagen walked out the door and were never to return. The city had notice of them, and the very next day, the very same day, any traumatizing events walked out the door, and in fact, Ms. McPherson was never even called back to the workplace, never tried to come back to the workplace ever, but in fact never even mentioned anything about it until June 2001.
But I mean, suppose Copenhagen hadn't been fired, so she had refused to come back to work. That would be a good case of constructive discharge, but what would it add to the underlying harassment?
I'm I'm not understanding your question.
I don't know what work constructive discharge does in a harassment case. If the harassment is severe enough to create constructive discharge, well, it's actionable whatever she does, whether she stays or leaves.
Well, the relevance of whether it was a constructive discharge is pertinent to the issue of whether the city can, in fact, avail itself of the Farragher-Neller affirmative defense. So that's why we believe it's pertinent and important to the analysis. We don't believe there is a constructive discharge or any tangible employment action in this case. As such, the city is entitled to the Farragher-Neller affirmative defense, which requires that they act promptly and reasonably to address and prevent any harassment, which I think is indisputable they did here. And secondly, you have to show
that if they didn't act reasonably and promptly, and as a result she was constructively discharged, they wouldn't have the shelter of the defense either.
Correct.
I just don't see what's added by calling it constructive discharge. I see what it adds to the harassment and the defense. I mean, I understand you have a separate issue, whether the way they treated her after, when she was on leave, you know, made her turn in her keys or something. I mean, that I see as a discrete constructive discharge issue.
And that...
Is that what the constructive discharge issue is, that by asking her to turn in the keys, made it seem as if they didn't want her to come back? Is that the idea?
Well, her contention is that, yes, by asking her to return her keys, by putting someone in place to do her job, by removing her personal belongings, and by receipt of the letter from Don Schultz saying she was absent without leave, that amounts to constructive discharge. And our response to that would be, even if her assumption of that were reasonable, which we don't contend it's not, it was no longer reasonable when Don Schultz sent a letter saying, we anxiously await Ms. McPherson's return to the workplace. To that, she promptly, the very same day, sent another letter, or her attorney did, saying, Ms. McPherson no longer can come to work for the city. So I don't think there's any reasonable question that Ms. McPherson resigned despite an invitation, and a friendly one at that, to say, help us, help her. We anxiously await her return. Her response was that she can no longer come back to the workplace that tolerated this. However, as the court noted below, that whatever hostile work environment there was gone the minute Copenhagen walked out the door, and was gone immediately. I wanted to draw the court's attention to one more issue regarding Ms. McPherson's failure to utilize the procedures. Any notion, or as the court knows, there's no excuse for someone saying, I was afraid, I couldn't do it. There's an abundance of case law that says that's insufficient. I think it's also important to note in the record that prior to this incident, Ms. McPherson had in fact utilized the grievance procedures and escalated her complaints significantly up the chain of command when she got involved in an altercation with a coworker.
Would Wieland be the first person, first supervisor that she would be expected to complain to?
Either Wieland or Nieves. Not that she would be expected to. Under the policy, it gives her several avenues. From just a practical standpoint, might she complain to Nieves? Maybe not, because at least the evidence shows that their relationship, that they had minor, I won't even say conflict, but they didn't get along. However, Wieland, who worked in the same office with them, which was the building department, as I said, was very, very good friends with Ms. McPherson. I did want to address one other issue that the court inquired of Mr. Stone about. Judge Roedner asked, what evidence was there that Copenhagen's supervisor had knowledge? And he, again, reinforced the bra comments. On pages 23 to 24 of Appellee's brief, we've cited a number of Seventh Circuit cases that denounce that idea. For instance, in Cook versus Stefani, the court determined that the employer was not unnoticed that it had a sexual harassment problem brewing, despite the fact that upper management had reprimanded the alleged harasser on one or more occasions for being too friendly with his staff, Likewise, in Putman, a single incident where a supervisor had called plaintiff a nigger did not warrant a finding that CBS was liable for its failure to prevent the plaintiff's supervisor. Gawley, as well, is a stellar example of where that idea has been rejected by this court, in that there were prior complaints, not by the plaintiff in Gawley, but there were prior complaints, yet her failure to utilize the procedures and protections in any manner damned her claim and warranted summary judgment for Indiana University in that case.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Gawley.
Thank you.
Mr. Stone, your time expired, but you may have a minute to rebut if you'd like.
I want to very quickly talk about how the city has consistently understated the facts of this case. Did Mr. Copenhagen harass other women? Yes, Michelle Brewington was another woman who was subject to the "what color is your bra" comment that treatment. Did Mr. Copenhagen plead guilty to a misdemeanor? No. Mr. Copenhagen pled guilty to a felony. He's on felony probation. He's a registered sex offender.
But oddly, you describe his crimes as minor.
I don't think I described his crimes.
Oh, yes, you do.
With respect, I think his crime of...
No, when you talk in your indemnity argument, you talk about the city being liable for employees who commit minor crimes.
The case law talks about...
Right,
yes.
Precisely, and you adopt that as a characterization of this case.
I consider his digital rape of an employee...
I was puzzled that you described it as minor. I was puzzled that you regarded it as a minor crime.
And finally, I don't think that comparing a case to an instance where a supervisor says something about being too friendly with the waitstaff is nearly the same as a situation where an employer says to his women staff, "What color are you wearing? What does it match your panties?" I find this case and hope that you find it patently offensive, and we ask that you reverse the court below.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stone.
Thank you very much, Judge.